Chapter 12. Obvious to all. I cannot say that I was alarmed at the phenomenon, because alarmed is, in my case, not exactly the word. It is possible, however, that, but for the brown stout, I might have been a little nervous. As for the rest of the company, they really made no attempt at concealing the downright fright which possessed them. Dr. Ponnener was a man to be pitied. Mr. Glidden, by some peculiar process, rendered himself invisible. Mr. Silk Buckingham, I fancy, will scarcely be so bold as to deny that he made his way, upon all fours, under the table. After the first shock of astonishment, however, we resolved, as a matter of course, upon further experiment forthwith. Our operations were now directed against the great toe of the right foot. We made an incision over the outside of the exterior os sesamoideum pollicis pedis, and thus got at the root of the abductor muscle. Readjusting the battery, we now applied the fluid to the bisected nerves when, with a movement of exceeding lifelikeness, the mummy first drew up its right knee so as to bring it nearly in contact with the abdomen, and then, straightening the limb with inconceivable force, bestowed a kick upon Dr. Ponnener, which had the effect of discharging that gentleman, like an arrow from a catapult, through a window into the street below. We rushed out en masse to bring in the mangled remains of the victim, but had the happiness to meet him upon the staircase, coming up in an unaccountable hurry, brimful of the most ardent philosophy, and more than ever impressed with the necessity of prosecuting our experiment with vigor and with zeal. It was by his advice, accordingly, that we made, upon the spot, a profound incision into the tip of the subject's nose, while the doctor himself, laying violent hands upon it, pulled it into vehement contact with the wire. Morally and physically, figuratively and literally, was the effect electric. In the first place, the corpse opened its eyes and winked very rapidly for several minutes, as does Mr. Barnes in the pantomime. In the second place, it sneezed. In the third, it sat upon end. In the fourth, it shook its fist in Dr. Ponnener's face. In the fifth, turning to Messrs. Glidden and Buckingham, it addressed them, in very capital Egyptian, thus: I must say, gentlemen, that I am as much surprised as I am mortified at your behavior. Of Dr. Ponnener nothing better was to be expected. He is a poor little fat fool who knows no better. I pity and forgive him. But you, Mr. Glidden, and you, Silk, who have traveled and resided in Egypt until one might imagine you to the manner born you, I say, who have been so much among us, that you speak Egyptian fully as well, I think, as you write your mother tongue, you, whom I have always been led to regard as the firm friend of the mummies, I really did anticipate more gentlemanly conduct from you. What am I to think of your standing quietly by, and seeing me thus unhandsomely used? What am I to suppose by your permitting Tom, Dick, and Harry to strip me of my coffins, and my clothes, in this wretchedly cold climate? In what light, to come to the point, am I to regard your aiding and abetting that miserable little villain, Dr. Ponnener, in pulling me by the nose? It will be taken for granted, no doubt, that upon hearing this speech under the circumstances, we all either made for the door, or fell into violent hysterics, or went off in a general swoon. One of these three things was, I say, to be expected. Indeed, each and all of these lines of conduct might have been very plausibly pursued. And, upon my word, I am at a loss to know how or why it was that we pursued neither the one nor the other. But, perhaps, the true reason is to be sought in the spirit of the age, which proceeds by the rule of contraries altogether, and is now usually admitted as the solution of everything in the way of paradox and impossibility. Or, perhaps, after all, it was only the mummy's exceedingly natural and matter-of-course air that divested his words of the terrible. However this may be, the facts are clear, and no member of our party betrayed any very particular trepidation, or seemed to consider that anything had gone very especially wrong. For my part, I was convinced it was all right, and merely stepped aside, out of the range of the Egyptian's fist. Dr. Poninger thrust his hands into his breeches pockets, looked hard at the mummy, and grew excessively red in the face. Mr. Glidden stroked his whiskers, and drew up the collar of his shirt. Mr. Buckingham hung down his head, and put his right thumb into the left corner of his mouth. The Egyptian regarded him with a severe countenance for some minutes and at length, with a sneer, said, "Why don't you speak, Mr. Buckingham? Did you hear what I asked you, or not? Do take your thumb out of your mouth." Mr. Buckingham, hereupon, gave a slight start, took his right thumb out of the left corner of his mouth, and, by way of indemnification, inserted his left thumb in the right corner of the aperture above mentioned. Not being able to get an answer from Mr. B, the figure turned peevishly to Mr. Glidden, and, in a peremptory tone, demanded in general terms what we all meant. Mr. Glidden replied at great length, in phonetics, "And but for the deficiency of American printing offices in hieroglyphical type, it would afford me much pleasure to record here, in the original, the whole of his very excellent speech. I may as well take this occasion to remark that all the subsequent conversation in which the mummy took a part was carried on in primitive Egyptian, through the medium, so far as concerned myself, and other untraveled members of the company, through the medium, I say, of Messrs. Glidden and Buckingham, as interpreters. These gentlemen spoke the mother tongue of the mummy with inimitable fluency and grace. But I could not help observing that owing, no doubt, to the introduction of images entirely modern, and, of course, entirely novel to the stranger, the two travelers were reduced, occasionally, to the employment of sensible forms for the purpose of conveying a particular meaning. Mr. Glidden, at one period, for example, could not make the Egyptian comprehend the term elytics, until he sketched upon the wall, with a bit of charcoal, a little carbuncle-nosed gentleman, out at elbows, standing upon a stump, with his left leg drawn back, right arm thrown forward, with his fist shut, the eyes rolled up toward heaven, and the mouth open at an angle of 90 degrees. Just in the same way Mr. Buckingham failed to convey the absolutely modern idea ig, until, at Dr. Poninger's suggestion, he grew very pale in the face, and consented to take off his own. It will be readily understood that Mr. Glidden's discourse turned chiefly upon the vast benefits accruing to science from the unrolling and disemboweling of mummies, apologizing, upon this score, for any disturbance that might have been occasioned him, in particular, the individual mummy called the Lamastachio, and concluding with a mere hint, for it could scarcely be considered more, that, as these little matters were now explained, it might be as well to proceed with the investigation intended. Here Dr. Poninger made ready his instruments. In regard to the latter suggestions of the orator, it appears that the Lamastachio had certain scruples of conscience, the nature of which I did not distinctly learn, but he expressed himself satisfied with the apologies tendered, and, getting down from the table, shook hands with the company all round. When the ceremony was at an end, we immediately busied ourselves in repairing the damages which our subject had sustained from the scalpel. We sewed up the wound in his temple, bandaged his foot, and applied a square inch of black plaster to the tip of his nose. It was now observed that the Count, this was the title, it seems, of a Lamastachio, had a slight fit of shivering, no doubt from the cold. The doctor immediately repaired to his wardrobe, and soon returned with a black dress coat, made in Jennings' best manner, a pair of sky-blue plaid pantaloons with straps, a pink gingham chemise, a flapped vest of brocade, a white sack overcoat, a walking cane with a hook, a hat with no brim, patent leather boots, straw-colored kid gloves, an eyeglass, a pair of whiskers, and a waterfall cravat. Owing to the disparity of size between the Count and the doctor, the proportion being as 2-to-1, there was some little difficulty in adjusting these habiliments upon the person of the Egyptian. But when all was arranged, he might have been said to be dressed. Mr. Glidden, therefore, gave him his arm, and led him to a comfortable chair by the fire, while the doctor rang the bell upon the spot, and ordered a supply of cigars and wine. The conversation soon grew animated. Much curiosity was, of course, expressed in regard to the somewhat remarkable fact of a Lamistakeo still remaining alive. I should have thought, observed Mr. Buckingham, that it is high time you were dead. Why, replied the Count, very much astonished, I am little more than 700 years old. My father lived 1,000, and was by no means in his dotage when he died. Here ensued a brisk series of questions and computations, by means of which it became evident that the antiquity of the mummy had been grossly misjudged. It had been 5,050 years and some months since he had been consigned to the catacombs at Eleithias. But my remark, resumed Mr. Buckingham, had no reference to your age at the period of interment. I am willing to grant, in fact, that you are still a young man, and my allusion was to the immensity of time during which, by your own showing, you must have been done up in asphaltum. In what? Said the Count. In asphaltum, persisted Mr. B. Ah, yes, I have some faint notion of what you mean. It might be made to answer, no doubt, but in my time we employed scarcely anything else than the bichloride of mercury. But what we are especially at a loss to understand, said Dr. Ponnener, is how it happens that, having been dead, and buried in Egypt 5,000 years ago, you are here today all alive and looking so delightfully well. Had I been, as you say, dead, replied the Count, it is more than probable that dead, I should still be, for I perceive you are yet in the infancy of Calvinism, and cannot accomplish with it what was a common thing among us in the old days. But the fact is, I fell into catalepsy, and it was considered by my best friends that I was either dead or should be. They accordingly embalmed me at once. I presume you are aware of the chief principle of the embalming process? Why, not altogether. Why, I perceive a deplorable condition of ignorance. Well, I cannot enter into details just now. But it is necessary to explain that to embalm, properly speaking, in Egypt, was to arrest indefinitely all the animal functions subjected to the process. I use the word animal in its widest sense, as including the physical not more than the moral and vital being. I repeat that the leading principle of embalmment consisted, with us, in the immediately arresting, and holding in perpetual abeyance, all the animal functions subjected to the process. To be brief, in whatever condition the individual was, at the period of embalmment, in that condition he remained. Now, as it is my good fortune to be of the blood of the Scarabaeus, I was embalmed alive, as you see me at present. The blood of the Scarabaeus! Exclaimed Dr. Ponnener. Yes. The Scarabaeus was the insignium or the arms, apostrophe of a very distinguished and very rare patrician family. To be of the blood of the Scarabaeus, apostrophe is merely to be one of that family, of which the Scarabaeus is the insignium. I speak figuratively. But what has this to do with you being alive? Why, it is the general custom in Egypt to deprive a corpse, before embalmment, of its bowels and brains. The race of the Scarabaei alone did not coincide with the custom. Had I not been a Scarabaeus, therefore, I should have been without bowels and brains, and without either it is inconvenient to live. I perceive that, said Mr. Buckingham, and I presume that all the entire mummies that come to hand are of the race of Scarabaea. Beyond doubt. I thought, said Mr. Glidden, very meekly, that the Scarabaeus was one of the Egyptian gods. One of the Egyptian what? Exclaimed the mummy, starting to its feet. Gods! Repeated the traveler. Mr. Glidden, I really am astonished to hear you talk in this style, said the Count, resuming his chair. And no nation upon the face of the earth has ever acknowledged more than one god. Hippus Garabius, the Ibis, etc., were with us. As similar creatures have been with others, the symbols, or media, through which we offered worship to the Creator to August, to be more directly approached. There was here a pause. At length the colloquy was renewed by Dr. Poninger. It is not improbable, then, from what you have explained, said he, that among the catacombs near the Nile there may exist other mummies of the Scarabius tribe, in a condition of vitality? There can be no question of it, replied the Count. All the Scarabia embalmed accidentally while alive, are alive now. Even some of those purposely so embalmed, may have been overlooked by their executors, and still remain in the tomb. Will you be kind enough to explain, I said, what you mean by purposely so embalmed? With great pleasure, answered the mummy, after surveying me leisurely through his eyeglass, for it was the first time I had ventured to address him a direct question. With great pleasure, he said. The usual duration of man's life, in my time, was about 800 years. Few men died, unless by most extraordinary accident, before the age of 600. Few lived longer than a decade of centuries, but 8 were considered the natural term. After the discovery of the embalming principle, as I have already described it to you, it occurred to our philosophers that a laudable curiosity might be gratified, and, at the same time, the interests of science much advanced, by living this natural term in installments. In the case of history, indeed, experience demonstrated that something of this kind was indispensable. An historian, for example, having attained the age of 500, would write a book with great labor, and then get himself carefully embalmed, leaving instructions to his executors pro tem, that they should cause him to be revivified after the lapse of a certain period, say 500 or 600 years. Resuming existence at the expiration of this time, he would invariably find his great work converted into a species of haphazard notebook, that is to say, into a kind of literary arena for the conflicting guesses, riddles, and personal squabbles of whole herds of exasperated commentators. These guesses, etc., which passed under the name of annotations, or emendations, were found so completely to have enveloped, distorted, and overwhelmed the text, that the author had to go about with a lantern, to discover his own book. When discovered, it was never worth the trouble of the search. After rewriting it throughout, it was regarded as the bounden duty of the historian, to set himself to work immediately in correcting, from his own private knowledge and experience, the traditions of the day concerning the epoch at which he had originally lived. Now this process of rescription and personal rectification, pursued by various individual sages from time to time, had the effect of preventing our history from degenerating into absolute fable. I beg your pardon, said Dr. Poninger at this point, laying his hand gently upon the arm of the Egyptian. Beg your pardon, sir, but may I presume to interrupt you for one moment? By all means, sir, replied the Count, drawing up. I merely wish to ask you a question, said the doctor. Why you mentioned the historian's personal correction of traditions respecting his own epoch? Pray, sir, upon an average, what proportion of these Kabbalah were? Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.